What we want to look at tonight is the unique self. And I guess the first question that we might have is, what is the unique self? The unique self is that part of you that you were born with, that part of you that was created by God that is uniquely you, and He made you unique so you can be a unique expression of His love. Now, you have to think of every person as a prism. Every prism has the same purpose, to receive light and to display it. In the same way, you have the same purpose, to receive the life of Christ and display it in a unique way. But God is not in the cookie-cutting business. He didn't make every one of us exactly the same. In Psalms 139:13, David says, "For you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb." Your inmost being is that unique self that God created within you. Now, some people call that your personality. Other people call it your temperament. I want to call it the unique self. And it's that part of you that you're born with and you cannot change. And I want to continue to emphasize that. This is the part of your makeup, your being, yourself, that can't be changed. Now, the place of our unique self is the soul. And if we go back to our diagram of the three circles, and the inner circle is spirit, then we have the soul, and then our body. Now, man was created out of the dust of the earth, and God breathed His spirit into him. At that point, the soul of man was created. The soul links the spirit with the body. And the soul is the means by which the spirit can express itself. In fact, every gift of the Spirit has to be expressed through the soul. Now, as soon as man's created and he becomes a living soul, you see him doing three things. He begins to think, he begins to feel, and he begins to choose. So the three basic elements of the soul are the mind, the will, and the emotions. Now, even the fruit of the Spirit has to be expressed through those three elements, through mind, will, or emotion. So without it, you can't express what's within. If we look at the way God creates man and the unique self, and we see that it's placed right here in the soul with mind, will, and emotions, here's one of the things that we'll notice. God doesn't show any partiality. So when it comes to mind, will, and emotion, God gives everyone, and I'm just going to, for illustration's sake, say 10 units. And that's how much you'll receive, 10 complete units. Now, some people have 8 units of mind, 1 unit of will, and 1 unit of emotion. But they have 10 units. Now, of course, we live in a society where we boast in the people who have 8 units in mind. But actually, they're not any better than a person who has 8 units in the area of will, and maybe 1 in mind and 1 in emotion. And they have 10 units also. I remember a fellow that I really enjoyed in Manhattan, Kansas, and he probably had 10 units of mind, and that was it. He was real, real eccentric. They kept several pets in their house, and I don't know how many cats and dogs were there, but I knew that there were enough cats and dogs that whenever you'd eat there, you'd spend half your time digging the hair out of your tongue. They just had too many pets. And the fellow drove a Volkswagen that had speakers mounted on the front. And I'd be driving around town, and I'd stop at a red light, and all of a sudden I'd hear this voice come out of the sky. "Mike, you need to check your right rear tire." And I'd look around, I wouldn't see anyone, and, "Mike, get out and check your right rear tire." So I'd get out of the car, and I'd look around, and finally I'd see him. He'd be about a block away in that Volkswagen with those speakers talking to me. And I'd get out and have to kick the tires and walk around, and then he'd give me the Roger okay and let me go. He had about 10 units of mind, but he wasn't any better than anyone else. You might have a person, again, with 10 units of willpower, awfully strong-willed. And some people say they're as strong as an acre of garlic. You can't get anywhere with them. Then you might have the person who has 8 units of emotion, 1 of mind, and 1 of will. Now, that's the person that cries every fall when the leaves fall off the trees. It's just such a sad, sad thing to have to see. And yet they have 10 units. What I want you to see in the illustration is this. God doesn't show partiality. You have 10 complete units. But unfortunately, there's many people today that feel inferior with the units that they have. And they've never come to grips with really loving how God made them. And I can promise you this, that if you'll begin to love how God made you, your heart will open wide to everyone else around you. I remember the seminary student that came in to me, and he said he had a problem. And the problem was this, he didn't like any of the other students. He just found fault in them, and he was always criticizing, and he just couldn't stand the other students that he had to deal with in graduate school. The first question that I asked him is, what is it that you don't like about yourself? See, if we're to love our neighbors as we love ourselves, and you see someone who's critical and hating others, immediately you can assume they don't like what they are. And what he didn't like about himself is that he had to study a lot longer and a lot harder to get B's in school than the fellows that didn't do anything and got A's. And he didn't like that. And yet he couldn't see some of the positive things that he possessed that they didn't. And every unique self has positive characteristics and negative characteristics. So we're going to break unique self into three categories: mind, will, and emotions. Either you're a thinker, a feeler, or a doer. Now, if any of you have had anything to do with temperament studies or temperament tests, you're probably familiar with the terms phlegmatic, choleric, sanguine, melancholy. Have you heard those terms before? And the question's often asked why I don't use those terms. Well, the main reason that I refuse to use those terms, or I don't like to use those terms, is that that whole concept of our unique self and our creation and being came from a man named Hippocrates, somewhere between 470 B.C. and 377 B.C. And he came up with this, with these different categories of man by looking at men as they were cut up and seeing the different colors of body fluid that came out of them. Now, that doesn't sound very scientific to me, nor does it sound very biblical. And I prefer to use a biblical model of mind, will, and emotions. And a three-part model of man from 1 Thessalonians 5:23, spirit, soul, and body. That in our soul, we have those three functions. That God expresses himself through those three functions. And it's those three functions, mind, will, and emotion, that make up your unique self. Now, one of the things that Hippocrates did discover, and I wouldn't say that it's unique to him, because it's something that every mother knows, and that's that every child that she has is different. And he made that point, that people by birth are different. And we want to make that point today, too, that people by birth are unique and different. Now, there is a danger when you begin to discuss the unique self and understanding what you are and what can't change, and that is that some people begin to obsess on it. And all they talk about is what they are and how they were created, and that's why they act that way. And it is valuable information. I think you'll see just how valuable it is. But we don't want to introduce a leaven into our teaching and our discipleship that's unhealthy, and that's what it can become. It's not a catch-all for our lives, and the understanding will help us, however. The other thing is, when we look at the unique self, and we have the test that we have concerning unique self, I don't want you to confuse unique self with spiritual gifts. And there's many people that do that. In fact, many of the spiritual gift tests are just temperament or personality tests. Because you'll notice in those temperament tests, the choleric or the driver is always a prophet. And I don't believe that that's right. I think that God gives the gifts as he wills. And it doesn't matter if you come out high as a thinker, a feeler, or a doer. That doesn't mean that you can't be a prophet. That doesn't mean that you can't be a teacher. It doesn't mean you can't be a counselor. Those things are spiritual gifts that God gives. One of the things that surprises many people that come to our mountaintop retreat is one of the fellows who is there is an extreme doer. He's self-driven and he's got a lot of motivation. And the reason it surprises everyone is he has the gift of serving. And he serves everyone that's around him. So the gifts don't necessarily track with your unique self. And I don't think that they have to at all. And you'll notice the majority of those spiritual gift tests are made by doers, and they always seem to end up at the top of the pile. The other problem I have with it is an unbeliever can take a spiritual gift test and he ends up with spiritual gifts. So there's a real problem there. I remember the first spiritual gift test I took, and I was really opposed to taking it. And I didn't feel any better after I'd taken it because I showed up as having the gift of martyrdom. Now, there's a cheery thought. And I looked at my test results and I was going over it with Betty and I said, you know, this looks kind of like a one-shot deal to me. You know, one of those gifts you just get to use once and that's it. And I just thought, how ridiculous to end up with the gift of martyrdom. And I was just hoping she wasn't going to take it seriously and decide to begin then. Now, when we talk about the unique self, and even the topic of self-life, it's often confusing for people. And here's why it's confusing, and maybe I'm the only one that is confused. But does it confuse you that you're to crucify self, Galatians 2:20? Then you're to deny self, Luke 9:23, and then in Matthew 19:11, you're supposed to love yourself. I don't get it. If it's bad enough to kill and it's gone, how come I need to keep denying it? And if it's bad enough to kill and deny, how come I'm supposed to love it? And as you read Christian authors, you can really get confused whenever they come to the topic of self. Well, I want to describe to you what they mean. And we just have a circle here in the middle of the page. And that in that circle, we put our unique self. It's how God created me. It's that unique prism to receive and display His life in a unique way. And that, of course, is made up of mind, will, and emotions. Now, what they're talking about in the Bible are three different selves. And we can describe that if we just go above this circle, self one, self two, and self three. What they're talking about is what drives the unique self. What's in charge of the unique self? What controls the unique self? And there are three distinct selves that can control the unique self. Now stick with me just a minute and you'll see what I mean. If I have the old man, the Adam life, the old nature, whatever you want to call it, controlling my unique self, how God created me to be, my unique self becomes distorted and I walk in the flesh. And I'm a carnal person. And I live in the flesh. So let's take for an example the Apostle Paul. He was a real doer. He's got a lot of units of willpower and do. God created him to start churches. But when the Adam life, the old man or the old nature, took charge of his unique self, and I want you to think of your unique self as a hammer. A hammer is not good or bad. What you do with the hammer is good or bad. Kill a little old lady with it, it's bad. Build her a house, it's good. If you take this hammer, his unique self, and Paul is driven, and you control it by the old man, the old nature, the Adam life, he walks in the flesh and he ends up killing Christians. He's a carnal man. Here's another example. Hugh Hefner, who started Playboy magazine, he's a real driver. I believe that God created him to start churches too. But because of the way his old nature, his Adam life, his old man was developed, a lot of female rejection, a lot of hurt and pain in his life, he took charge of that hammer, his unique self and his drive, and instead of starting churches, what did he start? Porno magazine. It's a distortion of how God created him. And this particular person is going to live in hell each day of their life, and eventually, someday, they're going to go to hell. Now, the solution to that condition we talked about the last three nights is Galatians 2:20. Take up the cross and deny yourself. Be crucified with Christ. And as I'm crucified with Christ, that old life is replaced with a new life, Christ's life. Then remember last night we talked about the baggage or the residue, the file cabinet in our brain that holds all the information about our old life. Our hurts are registered there, our idols are registered there, our unbelief is registered there. If I allow that baggage to control my unique self, again, I walk in the flesh. And you'll see carnality. And this particular person will live in hell each day, but they will go to heaven. They've been born again. They've replaced the old nature with Christ's life, but they've shut off Christ's life, and they're allowing the residue, the baggage of the old man, to continue to control them, and they walk in the flesh too. And they're carnal. The solution to that is Luke 9:23, take up the cross and deny yourself. Now, the third self that we want to focus on tonight is self number three, from Matthew 19:11. And that is allowing Christ Himself to rule in my unique self. And in doing that, I become a blessing to others. And you see, the Apostle Paul was driven to kill Christians, but he was crucified with Christ, the old life was replaced, he was taking up the cross daily, and you'll notice his unique self never changes. But the focus and purpose of his unique self changed, in that now he's driven to save Christians, to give his life for Christians. And if you allow Christ to rule in your unique self, you'll live in heaven today, and you'll go to heaven in the future. Now, it's important to understand the distinction between these three selves that control the unique self. If you don't, you may end up trying to deny something God created you to be. Now, as we look at the unique self patterns and characteristics, one of the things we'll find that if you came up high on the test as a thinker, you're quiet. By nature, you're quiet because your mind is operating all the time. Something's always up there in the hopper. You're always thinking about stuff. And if we tell you, you need to stop that and be bold and go door to door. And that would be denying yourself. If you'll start talking and yakking all the time and go door to door, you'll be bold in Christ. Well, if God created you to be a quiet thinker, that's more comfortable one-on-one with people, discipling, and I'm commanding you to deny that and go door-to-door, what's it going to do to you? It's going to drive you crazy. It'll drive your stress right up through the roof. It's just like today we have people who confuse demons and deeds of the flesh. And I even heard recently someone was casting out the demon of poverty. Well, we need to send them around our homes, don't we? Get rid of that ugly thing. Or the demon of lust, casting out the demon of lust. Lust isn't a demon, lust is a deed of the flesh. And you have to deal with deeds of the flesh at the cross. You can't cast it out. And if you try to cast it out, it's going to drive you crazy. If you try to change the unique self, what God created you to be, you'll be under stress and pressure all the time. So we need to understand who we are and not live under that kind of stress and pressure, but instead let Christ rule in what I am. Let Him rule in my quietness. Let Him rule in my activity. Let Him rule in all of my talk. Now, another reason that we need to understand the unique self is this, and we'll just draw a little V here, and at the bottom of the V, we'll put a dot. And that dot represents the beginning of a relationship. And that can be a relationship with your mate, or that can be a relationship with somebody in the church or someone at work. When you come into this relationship, you're carrying two bags. One bag holds the residue of the self-life, that file cabinet we talked about, with all our hurts, all our memories, all of our subjectivity, all of our little grids of emotion that we carry with us. If we were told repeatedly as a child that we were stupid and not bright and our brother was smarter than us, then we carry that with us and we're looking for messages to prove or disprove that. That's in one bag. In the other bag, I carry my unique self. And let's say that we're getting married and this woman brings into the relationship her two bags. Self-life patterns or flesh, the same old file cabinet, and her unique self. Now, tell me this. Do you think there might be reasons for a few firecrackers in that relationship? For a few explosions? Our unique selves are different. And not only that, our own self-life and flesh patterns are different. And here's what happens then. We immediately begin to spread in our relationship. And we'll come to a point with others around us of emotional divorce. That is, with my mind, I run away from divorce. And with my emotions, I run to divorce. And I'm in conflict. I've decided that person can't meet my needs. There's too much conflict with them. They don't understand me. They don't know me. And since I've emotionally divorced them, I've got to bring my mind in line with my emotions. So I start thinking up reasons for why I ought to treat them the way I do. And the enemy's right behind us whispering, helping us make a nice little list of everything that's wrong with that person. And since we want their behavior to prove what we feel, we examine every behavior, everything they say, and on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you think we make it out to be? A 10. Have you ever had that happen with your mate? When you've come in and you've said something to them and they just totally blow up and walk off? And what you've done is you just proved for them how they felt about you. Now, when you reach this point of emotional divorce, and I do want to say that this is part of the normal Christian life. Because you've been trying to milk your needs out of another person, and eventually you'll get it through your head that they can't meet your needs, and you'll emotionally divorce them. That's a normal part of marriage. In fact, I always like to remind people that the purpose of marriage is to be miserable. That's the primary purpose of marriage. Now, let me explain. The primary purpose of an automobile is to get you from point A to point B. The secondary purpose is if it can do it comfortably. If you confuse the primary with the secondary, and you think the primary purpose for a car is to get you there comfortably, and you buy one that looks real nice and it's real comfortable, but the thing doesn't have an engine, you've made the secondary reason the primary. You've bought it because of how good it looks, but you forgot the primary purpose, to go from point A to point B, and now you can't move in it. The primary purpose of marriage is to squeeze you and make you miserable. When you get all that self-life out of you and replace it with Christ's life, the secondary purpose is happiness. But if you're confused and you think the primary purpose for marriage is to be happy, I promise you a person will not make you happy. They won't meet the needs that Christ meets in you. You'll be unhappy with them. You'll get rid of them. You'll go to another person. They won't make you happy. And you have to see the primary purpose is to get miserable. And we do get miserable because we want the other person to meet needs only God can meet. Now, as we reach this point of emotional divorce, some people go through with physical divorce. But there is a way to come back to a point of oneness. And there's two things that'll take us back to this point of oneness. Understanding, on the one hand, and the cross, on the other hand. Now, let me just give you a little analogy. A couple comes in, and she says, I'm mad at my husband. I'm fixing to leave him. I can't take it anymore. And I say, he's sitting there with her, what did he do? He took me to McDonald's for lunch. Now, I admit, taking somebody to McDonald's at lunch is a mean thing to do. But for her, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 10. She's mad. Let's just look for a minute in her little self bag that she brought into the marriage. She's a very intelligent girl, but she was told that she was stupid. She was in competition with her sisters. She always felt some inferiority, some feelings of worthlessness. And then let's look at her unique self bag. She's a thinker. And a thinker defines love doing special, little, unique things for me. That's how they define love. And they'll love you the way they want to be loved. Is there anything special about McDonald's? Anything unique about McDonald's? And not only that, her husband took a friend out for dinner to a $50 a plate restaurant. So now she feels more inferior, more worthless. That event to her, if you can get into her shoes for just a minute, on a scale of 1 to 10 is a 10. Does that make sense? And this is really what I want you to be able to do in discipleship, is to get into the other person's shoes. Don't disciple them from your unique self, but from theirs. So I explained both of those bags to her. And she understood that, and I explained them to him. Do you understand how your wife perceived that? How she read what you were doing? Well, you could see them start to even scoot closer together. And then I said, now let's look at your self patterns. And I looked at his. And in his file cabinet, full of the old residue, is a mother that he could never please, never do anything good enough for, always condemning every action, every step that he took. And so immediately, as soon as anyone says anything to him about his behavior, he's upset. Because it's confirming what he's always been told. And in his unique self, he's a doer. And he spells love T-I-M-E. I thought I was showing you a lot of love just driving over there, just to be with you. And immediately as they came into that understanding, you saw them move closer together. Now, after that, I did what I do with all couples as we go through this material. I put a Bible in her lap and I said, let's just assume for a minute that your husband really was telling you that you're worthless, no good, and you don't matter. Show me chapter and verse that excuses your behavior. Let's just say that's really what he was saying about you. Where do you come off acting like that? Where do you come off getting mad? Where does the Bible say that you have the right to be angry over that kind of treatment? And of course, he's loving this. All the men do. And she said, well, there's not anything there that excuses that. And I take the Bible out of the wife's lap, as I always do, and I put it in his. And say, now, let's just assume that you can't make her happy. There's nothing you do that's right. And she doesn't appreciate you. Show me chapter and verse that excuses your behavior. And he said, it's not there. And I said, see, neither one of you took up the cross. If you would have taken up the cross and denied self and walked in the cross and reckoned yourself dead and not dug the old man out of the coffin and carried it around asking somebody to kiss it and approve of it, if you would have taken up the cross and not been so self-centered and self-serving and self-seeking, you would have never needed the understanding. See, it's nice when we have understanding with the cross, but we don't have to have it. The cross is really all we need. See, my wife doesn't have an excuse. No matter what I do, she has to take up the cross, deny herself, and love me. But I think there is an advantage in having understanding because there's some things I need not do that are going to push her button. It's hard enough taking up the cross daily without having somebody do things that annoy you constantly. And sometimes you may feel like in your marriage you're at the bottom of a hand-dug well and you dig your way up through the top and you hold on to the rocks and you claw and claw and claw and you get one leg up and one arm up on the side of the well and then your mate takes a bat and knocks you back down in there. And you try to climb up again. Well, I think it helps us to understand what's in this unique self bag. Now, the last three nights we've talked about what's in the flesh bag, the residue. But it will be valuable for us to understand this. And the two together can bring us in any relationship back to a point of oneness. Understanding your unique self also helps you as a parent. It helps you in understanding how your child thinks and how they feel and how they act. And one of the things that you understand right away is that you don't discipline all three kids the same way. If you have a thinker, a feeler, and a doer. They all respond differently. They all need different things. And even the way we pray for them, if you have a child that's a thinker, one of the things you ought to pray for them is that they not spiral into criticalness. See, they've always got to have something in their mind, and if they put something bad in their mind, they'll just spiral into it because they'll dance around it and think about it. You have to pray that they're guarded against depression. Thinkers have the highest rate of suicide because they think about all the bad and obsess on it. If you've got a child that's a feeler, one of the things you need to continually pray for them is that they not follow the morals of a crowd because they're easily led, easily manipulated. If you've got a child that's a doer, you need to pray against their impulsiveness and their tendency to use people to get their way. And then if you're disciplining your children and you have a child that's a thinker, and you discipline them by saying to them you have to write your name 100 times. That's no punishment for a thinker. They'll line up each letter of their name and make it look a little better than the last one. And they'll make sure they're all lined up. Is that punishment? Stand them in a corner. That's no punishment. They'll start counting the dots. And they'll find how many are there in each square inch of that little wall. That's not going to do anything for them. Now, if you have a child that's a feeler and you really want to get to them, take away their phone privileges. Don't let them talk to somebody. Because I promise you, they only go to school because that's a good place to keep track of their friends. If you've got a child that's a doer and you want to punish them, put them in their room. That'll drive them crazy. It's like a cage. They need out of there. They want to be able to do things. If you've got a child that's a thinker, it's important that you always be consistent with that child.
or tell them that you're going to do. If you've got a feeler, it sure doesn't hurt any to walk by them and give them a hug every once in a while. Set them on your lap. Tell them that you love them. And if you got a doer, get out there and do some projects with them. And let them work with their hands and release some of that energy and get on. Now the fourth reason that I think it's important to understand our unique self is that it lessens our judgment of others and increases our enjoyment of the family of God. When you really begin to see the uniqueness in the people around you, the uniqueness in the body of Christ, you will begin to enjoy them. But I promise you, you can't enjoy them if you're all the time trying to get them to act like you. Nor can you enjoy them if you judge their behavior on the basis of what you would be saying in that same behavior. Here's a simple scripture. You who judge practice the very same things. You assume that other people are saying to you by their behavior what you would be saying to them if you were behaving that way. Let me give you an example. My wife is a thinker. When she's quiet, she's thinking. Everything's going around in her mind. She's thinking about all this stuff. I'm a feeler. When I'm quiet, I'm mad. Well, I spent 10 years of my marriage thinking what? She was mad when she was just thinking. And since she was mad at me and wouldn't tell me why, I'd just get mad back at her and not tell her why. And then I'd punish her the way that it would most effective, that I could most effectively be punished. I'd withdraw from her. And of course, for a thinker, they don't mind that at all. They're glad you're out of their way. And you end up with all that kind of confusion, and you can't enjoy other people because you don't understand their differences and what they're saying to you through their behavior. Now, as we look at the unique self-test that you took, I want you to notice that there's three areas on the test. The unique self T, and I didn't tell you that meant thinker. You probably guessed that. The unique self D, which is a doer, and then a feeler. You have the thinker, the doer, and the feeler. And again, we're looking at the three basic functions of the soul, mind, will, and emotion. The unique self is made up of those three. And I wanted to find, out of those three, which was primary for you. Which is your primary unique self pattern. Are you a high in the thinking area, the doer area, or the feeler area? And all you need to do is you add up how many yeses you had checked. And let's say that you had 7 yeses in the thinker. And then you come down here in the nose and you had 9. That would give you a score of a -2. And you go to the bar chart over here to a -2 and put a little line there. And then in the area of the doer, let's say that you add all those up and you've got 15 in the yes and 1 over here. That gives you a 14. You come over to the 14 and put a line there. And then the same thing for the feeler. And this person is a 10 here in the yes and a 6 here. That gives you 4. So they're at the +4. Now, as we look at that, we see which pattern we're highest in. Now, there are very few people who are compulsive in their unique self pattern. That is, there's very few people that will come up a +16 in one of these three bar charts and a 0 at the other two, or a -16 at the other two. But it does happen, and that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with you if you come out a -16 all the way across the bottom. We're looking at unique self patterns. And as I said, there's not any pattern that's better than another one. But I want you to be able to understand what is normal for you. And that's important for me that you understand what is normal. Now, if we look at these three basic patterns, the feeler, the thinker, and the doer, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12:27, you are individually members. He says you're individual and you're different. You're unique. And he uses the analogy of the body. And that's a good analogy. Because we see these three basic functions in the body too. In the soul, we have mind, will, and emotion. In the body, we have the internal perfectionist organs. That's the thinker. And every family, every business, every ministry, every church is a success because of attention to detail. And these people are detailed oriented. They love detail and they work in detail, the thinker. And you could think of your heart as being a perfectionist organ. And that may seem kind of boring to some of you, but do you want your heart to do anything other than beat today? I'd just soon it didn't decide that it needed a lot of variety. I'd like it to just do the same thing. Then you have the doer, and that would be our muscles. And the more muscle you have, the more you can get what you want done. And so people with a lot of muscle can have a tendency to be a bit of a bully. But it also allows them to forge ahead. And then you have the feeler, and the feelers are like your senses. Your senses put your whole body in touch with the world outside you. Touch, taste, all of those things. And these feelers put the body of Christ in touch with the world outside of them. They see people that are hurting. And they want to minister to those hurting people. Now let me just give you some examples, and you'll see what I mean by being a thinker, a feeler, or a doer. Those three basic unique self patterns. Let's imagine that you're on the front of the Titanic and it's sinking. And the boat's starting to sink and the water's coming up. Who do you want with you on the bow of that boat? I want a doer with me. Because he'll make decisions this quick. Alright, all you fellas, give me your belts. We're going to grab those chunks of boards over there. We're going to wrap our belts around them. We're going to tie them together and we'll jump off and float. Hey, it's a plan. The water's coming up. It doesn't sound too bad to me. I don't want a thinker with me. You know what they'll do? They'll hold on to their belt with both hands and say, what makes you think this is going to work? Now, mind you, the water's coming up about 3 feet a minute, and they're holding on to their belt. Well, I want to be sure it's going to work. I want to know. I don't want a feeler with me. They'll walk up to me and put their arms around me, and with great big crocodile tears say, Mike, it's a shame you're going to die and you got a wife and 3 kids. You know you'll never see them again. And they just bawl and bawl and bawl. Well, that's nice, but I want somebody with a plan. Now, if I inherit $1 million, I don't even want to meet a doer. They won't ask me what I want to do with my money. They'll tell me. And they'll have me investing in that catskin farm. You know, the one where you feed the rats to the cats and the cats to the rats and you get skins for nothing? And he won't ever ask the question, does anyone buy catskin coats? He's just going to tell me. I want to talk to the thinker, the analytical person, the one who has to have assurances before they act. I want them to give me my advice. I don't want to talk to the feeler. They'll have me giving it to somebody down the block that they really feel sorry for and they think that they ought to have it. Now imagine that the three of you, a thinker, feeler, and a doer, are in a restaurant. And there's a fourth person there, and that fourth person has just eaten some lettuce, and a big chunk of that lettuce is stuck right between their two front teeth. Here's what the thinker does. They just stop. They're paralyzed. They can't budge. Something's out of place here. They need to get that out of their teeth. They can't even go on eating and enjoying the meal until that's over with. They just sit there staring at the person's mouth. Then you got the feeler, and they're in absolute turmoil. They're just wringing their hands. I feel so embarrassed for them, I don't know what to say. If I say anything, they may be more embarrassed, but I can't stand to have them go out the house or out the front door with other people making fun of them. I just don't know what to do. If I tell them, maybe they'll be offended. Oh, my, I don't want to offend anyone. And they're just wringing their hands. The doer looks up, and he sees the lettuce and doesn't say a word to anybody, reaches in, gets out a big buck knife and opens it up and reaches across and just tears it out of the guy's teeth. And when he does that, he cuts his lip, and the guy starts crying. He says, shut up, that's what Band-Aids are for. Just get with it. What if you have these three people who go in to a clinic to get their shots? And you tell them you can have your shot Monday through Friday. When do you want your shot? The thinker wants theirs Friday. They want plenty of time to obsess on it. The feeler says, hurry up and get it over with right away. Get the thing done right now, right now. The doer yanks the needle out of your hand and gives it to himself. Doesn't bother him any. If you see these people moving in to a parking spot, how are they going to park? Well, I'll tell you how the thinker's going to park, right between the lines. 12 inches on each side of that yellow line. And they're going to be very annoyed at the people who park too close to the yellow line. That is one of the things they can't stand. People should keep the rules. The doer, when he sees two cars and they're both parked over the yellow lines, he just floors it and squeezes himself right between them. Knocks the front window out and crawls out. He doesn't care. The feeler, they're the one that pulled in and just parked at an angle, and they take three spaces. It's different how each person perceives that. If you look in their rooms as kids, the thinker's room is going to be perfectly clean and in order. They like to have it all together. Now, a perfectionist or a thinker can have a sloppy house if they can't get it all under control. They'll give up on their house and they'll withdraw to something they can control. And they'll keep backing up and backing up till they can get something right because they have security in that, having everything stable and fixed. The doer's room will be clean if he's talked one of the other kids into doing it. And he won't ask them, he'll tell them to come along and we're going to do it. The doer's the one that invites you over to calls you up and says, hey, I'd like you to come over and wallpaper and bring the paste. They're going to let you have their way. The feeler's room has everything scattered everywhere because they're oblivious to those kind of things. I remember a lady that brought her a daughter into me and said, I need you to counsel her. She's really got some serious problems. And I said, well, what kind of problems does she have? Well, she's not serious and as studious as my son. Now, my son's gone to MIT and he had an IQ, the temperature of the sun, and he never left his room and all this kind of stuff, and there's something wrong with my daughter. Well, obviously her son was a thinker, and she was trying to shove her daughter into the same mold. Her daughter comes in to see me. She has flaming red hair, sits back in the chair, puts her feet up on my desk, and starts telling me about the sex life of all of her friends and how she's helping them. Just open mouth and engage, and she just went on and on and on, and you couldn't help but like her. I called her mother in later and I said, leave that kid alone. She'll get just as good a job, not because of her intellect, but because she's able to sell herself. And I said, it's just as ridiculous to tell your son to go out and be the life of the party as it is to tell her to be a bookworm. And do you know if you have a kid that's high on the feeler scale, I don't really believe you ought to require straight A's out of them, even if they can give them to you. I think instead you ought to require that they do their best, but you need to understand that they need time with other kids and they need activities. Now you can look at these three unique selves in another way, and I'll just draw a little pyramid. And at the very top of the pyramid, again, we'll put our dot. And we'll put the thinker at the top. They are people who are concerned with the dots of life, the little details of life, those important little things. And if you've said anything to them, believe me, they've analyzed it all the way out. If you said that was a poor pot roast, they'll start thinking of all the times, because they keep invisible lists, that you've said things about their cooking, and the thing you said in 1975 in front of their mother about their cooking, and they'll go all the way through here, and by the end, they've got you down to the point where you wanted to divorce them. They just analyze it to the very end. Now, there's a real advantage to that kind of a person. I know a fellow who's a computer designer, and they came up with a new computer board, and in the middle of it, they were showing the men at a business meeting that went Monday to Saturday, this little chip that fits in the middle. And they said, now no one else has that chip, no other competitor, it's third the size of anyone else's, we're going to really be able to do business. That's what they said Monday morning. Tuesday they talked about marketing, Wednesday manufacturing, the next day sales, and it went on and on and on until Saturday evening. In the close of the meeting, the president says, are there any closing comments? And this fellow raises his hand and goes, about that chip. He never got past it. He'd analyzed it all week. And the guy goes, what about the chip? And he says, well, if only one company makes it, what are we going to do if that company triples the price next year? And this president looked at everyone else that worked for him. He goes, what are we going to do? And they go, we don't know. And he said, well, I've been thinking about this. And we can put the chip other people make in the corner and make a little one that makes up for the difference in its functionability. And there's 30 companies that make that chip. Well, they thought he was a god, a genius. And I want you to see that your temperament isn't good or bad. It's like a hammer. It's who's in charge of it, who's in control of it. And these people, the thinker, like to look at the little details of life. I remember I was getting ready to take a trip to Africa. And I told my wife, I'm going to head out for Africa and do this, do that. And she says, well, where are you going to stay when your first layover in Cairo? And I said, well, I don't have a place to stay in Cairo. I'll either sleep in the airport or I'll get a cab driver and find a place or go out on the street. I'll do something. I said, I'm not really worried about it. She goes, oh, I'm glad I don't go with you. And I said, well, what are you going to do while I'm gone? And she said, I've been waiting for 4 years to clean the cupboards. I'm going to get those things clean and get all the dirt out of the corners, and I'm going to move the glasses so the little ones are in front and the big ones are in the back. And then I'm going to clean all these cupboards up. Well, from my perspective, let's do that over lunch. Let's tear that stuff out of there and get it done. But see, she's glad I'm leaving, because if I'm around and I help, I won't use that old secondhand toothbrush to get that little bit out of the corner and do all this. But you know what? When I came back, I went into the kitchen and she'd cleaned the cupboards, the front of them, with that finish. You know, the cleaner that has the finish in it, and it covered up the scratches. It really did look sharp. And it was nice to have the glass, little glasses in the front and the big ones in the back. Now, it didn't take me long to reverse all that. But my point is, I looked at that and I really did appreciate what she'd done. And there are many people that fail because they don't appreciate the people who have attention to detail. And they just can't see it. So these people at the very top are thinkers. They obsess on little things. And one of the things I want you to know about them right away, if you're married to one, their task equals their identity. They can't separate what they're doing from their own person. Now, if I go into the kitchen and my wife's chopping carrots and I say, you know, there's a faster way to chop those carrots, Mr. Advice, Mr. Advice in here telling me I can't even chop a carrot right. Now, that is common. These people do not separate their task from their identity. That's why the majority of the apostles were thinkers, because they had attention to detail, to quality, to the message they received. They weren't going to allow it to be changed. And if someone tried to change that, they were trying to change them, and they'd put up a fight. They didn't like it. They couldn't go with it. Now, me, on the other hand, if my wife says to me, go out there and trim those bushes. You know, we've been waiting 2 years for you to trim them. So I go out and trim them and whack away on them, and she comes out and says, boy, those things look terrible. And I say, yeah, you should have seen them before I started. And I'm headed to the garage. I'm done with it. Task doesn't equal my identity. But do you see that if you're married to someone that their task equals their identity, how much trouble you can get into with them in short order? They just don't separate it, and they need to learn to separate it. Now, the animal that probably best describes the thinker is a little beaver. They like to stay in their one little area. They like to get their logs piled up where they ought to be. They like to do things right. They like to store ahead. They like to have everything in its place. In the middle of this pyramid, we have the doer. And the doer is an interesting person in that they're task-oriented and relationship-oriented both. But they use relationships to accomplish the task. People are a tool for them to get the job done. And I often describe them as they're the hub of the wheel, and every other person is a spoke that's supposed to support them, and that allows them to be a big wheel. And they like to be big wheels. And if you see Paul moving along in his ministry, and he's a real doer, if somebody isn't supporting him, they get out of the way. Because we've got a job to get done. We've got a task. I need people. I want people around me, but I want them around me to get the job done. And again, these people are like the muscle. And they can't give any attention to detail. They don't like it. They also don't see any obstacles. And you see Paul, who's beat half to death, left for dead. They pray for him and he comes to, and his first response is, things are looking up. You can't detract him with the facts. He's got a job and he's going to move ahead and he's going to plow ahead and he's going to get the thing done. And these people are most like a lion. Now, what happens when you cage a lion? It starts pacing back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Whenever you tell this doer they can't do what they want to do, they'll start pacing back and forth. And the only thing they'll stop for is to bite your hand off if you stick it in the cage. And they begin to look for a savior, somebody that'll come by and agree with them and open the cage and let them get on with what they want to do. Now remember, when we're talking about these unique self characteristics and traits, they cannot change. It's what you are. The important thing is that it be under the Spirit's rule. Anything in your temperament can be negative or positive depending on who controls it. The thinker is a highly critical person. And when that criticism is turned within and that criticism is turned to others, it's destructive. But when they sit in the church and it's under the Spirit's rule and they begin to question what you're saying and they say, wait a minute, we're not going to accept all this teaching till we see where it leads us. Till we find out about this and we find out about that. Is there anything wrong with that? That's a positive trait. I have surrounded myself with those kind of people. And I really appreciate them. I know I'm more of an annoyance to them than they are to me. But I like their consistency, being able to see what's coming around the bend and keeping me safe. These doers created the phrase, it's just paperwork. You know, they don't, all is just paperwork. Why are you making me do that? At the bottom of the pyramid, we put the feeler. And for the feeler, relationships equal their identity. If relationships are going bad, their life is bad. So my wife can say to me, I don't like the way you trimmed the bushes. They look pretty bad. And I could care less. But if she said you hurt your daughter's feelings, I can go right to the bottom. See, the thinker has mood swings that go up and down depending on what they're thinking about. Think about the bad, they're at the bottom. Think about the good, they're at the top. That's why the key verse for them is Philippians 4, 6 through 8. Whatever is true and right and pure and lovely and of good reproach, let your mind dwell on those things. 4, 6 through 8. And I recommend that the thinker have a little card in their purse or in their shirt pocket of the positive things in life. The doer goes up and down depending on how much he's able to get done. How well the task is going. The feeler goes up and down depending on how relationships are. If they're good, he's up. If they're bad, he's at the bottom. He's highly sensitive, highly subjective. But one of the things about him is this. He can get up in the morning and walk out in the feedlot and be up to his waist in horse manure and look at the sun coming up and say it's going to be a great day. And they can really influence you by their attitude, their enthusiastic approach to life. Probably the best animal that describes them is the old Labrador Retriever. What they really want is just a pat on the head. If you're married to one of them, it wouldn't hurt at all to give them a little hug once in a while. Now, understanding the unique selves also helps me in my perception of other people. And I want to deal with that just a little more. My grandfather was telling me a story about a farmer who had a pig that was just getting ready to have babies. And he brought out his son that was 5 years old and he said, now listen, I want you to watch this old sow because she's got a habit of eating her babies. And when she starts to eat them, you get those babies away from her or you holler for me. So the farmer went out and he worked for a couple hours in the field and he came back and there his son's standing there up against the wall watching this old sow eat one of the babies. And the farmer says, I thought I told you to watch that old sow and make sure that she didn't eat those babies. And he goes, oh, Dad, don't worry. It's the 12th time it's come back out. Well, just a little different perception. For him, they were just circulating. For the farmer, he was losing his pigs. Now, we have different perceptions, different ways of seeing things. And each one of you has a heart dictionary with different definitions in it. And you may not possess the dictionary that the people around you have. For example, if you pull the heart dictionary out of a thinker and you look up love, it says to do special little things for me. If you look up or pull the dictionary out of the heart of a feeler and look up the word love, it just says sex. So one day there's a big explosion and the thinker says, you don't love me. And the feeler goes, I've been ready to go to bed with you every night. See, from their perspective, he's loving. From her perspective, he's not loving at all. So it's important to understand that we have a different perspective, a different way of looking at things, a different perception of events. And let's use for an example the Empire State Building. And we have a doer down here at the bottom of the Empire State Building. And let's just say that's your husband and he's extremely dominant. Then we have a thinker up here. And from the husband's perspective, the wife is real passive. So he yells up at her and he says, I don't like this. I don't like the way you are. You're too passive. You need to make your own decisions. You need to get out there. You need to be more assertive. You need to take charge. So this wife works real hard and she comes down 3 floors from the top. That's a 300% improvement from her perspective, right? She had to work to get there. And she hangs out the window and waves at him, and what do you think he says? Does she look any closer to him? No, what's he say? Aren't you going to do anything? Aren't you going to work at this at all? And she says, rain on you. That was enough work. I'll go right back up here where I'm comfortable. So he ends up creating in his wife the very thing that he doesn't like. Does that make sense? And she yells down at him and says, you're too dominant. You run right over me. I wish you'd stop that. So he moves up 3 floors, waves at her. Does he look any closer to her? He's made a 300% improvement. And she yells at him and says, aren't you going to do anything? And then he just moves back here where he's comfortable to the bottom. When we don't understand the unique self in others, first of all, we drive them to change. We're angry with them because they're not like us. We can't appreciate what they are. We can't subcontract our weaknesses. As one millionaire I was discipling said, when I asked him, how did you become a millionaire? He said, well, I subcontract my weaknesses. He said, very few people do that. Most people only hire others that are exactly like them. But he said, I never do. I hire people who are opposite of me and we fight all the time, but I keep going to the bank. The only requirement I have is you can't slander the company. And do you know we're all different in the body of Christ? And the only requirement is you can't slander other members. But you can enjoy your difference and be different. So we look at this and we continue to drive another person into what we want them to be. And it's real effort and work for them and we don't understand it. And so I take a thinker and tell them that they have to go door-to-door evangelizing. And watch their stress go up. Because they can't do that. You want to watch a doer's stress go up? Tell him he can't go and he's got to follow up on the people he led to the Lord last week. If you're in a church where the pastor is a real doer, many in the congregation feel like they've been spiritually raped. You know, he pursued them until they joined the church and then he dropped them like a hotcake because it was a commitment. He didn't want to have to work through their problems. He didn't want to have to help them. He just dumps them right away and gets on his way. It's just as difficult for him. In fact, I'd say it's supernatural for him to follow up, just as it would be supernatural for this person to go out and begin to evangelize.